There is so much that goes into one bottle of wine. So much time, so many resources, so much careful thought.
This big body of water, Lake Michigan, it has so much love to give us.
I was the young generation, now I'm the old one. It's funny how that happens, you know?
I'm adverse to publications of wine to some degree because the people that are writing these articles are living in a vacuum.
Americans have embraced wine more. We've become more of a wine culture.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 327. This week, we feature Wayne Bailey of Youngberg Hill in the Willamette Valley, Oregon. While all 50 states now produce wine, Oregon has gained a solid reputation for some of the very best Pinot Noir in the country. The Willamette Valley has grown, and producers are expanding the grapes they farm. Wayne Bailey, winemaker at Youngberg Hill, is one of those producers. Though the winery hangs its hat on Pinot, Wayne has no problem stepping out of his comfort zone. Take a listen and see why. You can also listen to Wayne on our Vino Lingo segment, defining the wine term, wine grower. Another fantastic view, another fantastic place to be in Oregon. I'm here with Wayne Bailey, and Wayne is the wine grower of Youngberg Hill. And how you doing?
I'm doing great, Ray. Thanks.
Thanks for having me up here. This has got to be a tough place to come to work every day.
Well, considering that I live here, I don't go to work at all.
Oh.
I just wake up and start living.
Nice. It's good. This is also an inn, too, from what I understand.
Yes,
is that right?
We operate like a bed and breakfast. We've got 9 guest rooms and overlooking the vineyard and the entire valley and the Coast Range. And, of course, we're in great proximity to McMinnville. Mm-hmm. And, of course, and we have our tasting room up here as well.
Very nice. It's a great setup. Well, I guess the first thing I want to do is talk about your wines. Tell me about what you're growing here and what you're making.
We're growing Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, and Pinot Gris. I also buy some fruit to make a Pinot Blanc and Grenache and Syrah. Sometimes I make a blend, sometimes I bottle them separately. This coming year, 2018 vintage, we're releasing our first rosé.
Oh, nice.
From Pinot Noir fruit. So we're continuing to expand. Later this year, we'll be releasing our first vintage of sparkling coming from fruit here in the valley. So got a lot of different things going.
Yeah, well, I think that's kind of indicative of being in the wine business. You have to kind of keep dancing.
It is. I would be totally fine myself just to do Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. I mean, that's what I came to the valley to do.
Yeah, sure.
Your public demands more.
Your fans try to give more. How many acres are you farming here?
We have 50 acres total, 23 acres planted in vines, 20 of those producing 3 acres that we just planted this last fall. 15 of that, 18 of that is Pinot Noir. All the way back from 30-year-old vines on owned root, some of the original vines. And then we also have 2.5 acres of Chardonnay and 2.5 acres of Pinot Gris.
So we were talking about those as we drove up. As we look into the vineyard from here to the right, are those the older vines? Just because they look older.
Yes.
But, you know.
The ones farther up here on the hill.
Right. Exactly.
That's correct. Yeah. They're the 30-year-old Pommard and Danesville clones.
Amazing.
So, yeah, there's not too many of them in the valley anymore since Phylloxera came in. But we're one of the lucky ones.
Yeah, yeah. Was it slower, Phylloxera, getting up to this area? Is that why? Or?
Well, it was later up here than it was in California. But as with most places, you know, when you get up farther north, up in the Dundee area and so on, the density of vineyards close to each other. And back then, a lot of them were farmed by the same people with the same equipment and everything else. You had it just spread like wildfire. So fortunately, as you can see, we're somewhat isolated, somewhat further away. We're colder, higher in altitude. All those things add up to being able to so far not have any influence of it. When we first bought the property, my comment was always, you know, when. Ultimately, I'm to the point now where I'm thinking if.
Yeah, yeah. That's good. That's an expert.
That's great. I'd love to have 50-year-old vines on the hill.
Now, you're going to forgive my ignorant question, I hope. Are you also owner?
Yes.
Okay, well, I didn't get that in the beginning.
Technically, I'm married to the owner.
Oh, okay.
In fact, I can tell you the Rosé, the Syrah, the Grenache, and the sparkling wine that we're making are all because of her, not because of me.
Oh, really?
If it were me, again, I'd be growing Pinot and Chardonnay, be very happy. But she likes other stuff. So
these were strong suggestions.
So it's yes, dear. Whatever you say, my love.
Well, you know, you got to keep things good.
That's right.
Yeah. And when it comes to wine, why not, right?
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And actually, in reality, I'm learning a lot through the process. You know, tasting still wine that is going to be making the sparkling is a whole different scenario, because you're just, you know, I'm not used to doing it. So to do that and be able to try to understand this wine that you're tasting now that's still, that is going to be in bottle for two or three years before you dosage and then, you know, make a final product is quite a learning experience.
Daunting, I would think,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, you kind of left. I'm kind of hanging on that whole thought of going into a process like this. Is this an education thing you go through? Is this something you tap into other winemakers? I mean, how does that work for
it's,
you?
It's a combination of everything. The sparkling, for example, we are working with a gentleman who does it on a custom basis, who actually was the assistant winemaker at Argyle, so he's got that process down pretty well. And so, you know, my job is first of all, give him great quality fruit and then juice to bottle, and then look for his direction in terms of how that wine, better understanding how that wine is going to be 3 years down the road in the bottle, and then what dosage, how that translates into the bottle and into the finished product, which I had never done before. So,
sure, yeah.
So that, but in reality, it's just another one of those parts of learning. And one of the things I love about our industry is that we're constantly learning. It starts with every vintage. Every vintage is very uniquely different because the weather is different every year. So we're every year, the fruit coming into the winery is a new experience. So that's part of it. Working with other fruits such as Grenache or Syrah coming out of Southern Oregon, that's always a learning experience. And by virtue of working with that fruit, it may teach you something in terms of, well, we've always done Pinot Noir this way. What if we did something like that, that were you doing for the Grenache, and vice versa? Yeah. So it's always experimentation and working. And yeah, I mentioned Andrew, but I make my wine at Robert Britton's facility. And so Robert is always there and we're always going back and forth and tasting each other's wine and going through the cellar. And so that's part of the learning experience as well.
You're perpetually the open-minded guy.
Yeah,
really.
Absolutely. I'm a blank sheet of paper, as my wife would say.
How many vintages have you done?
Yeah, 16 here and 2 in Burgundy.
Nice. And when were you working in Burgundy?
Early 90s. It was 91 through 93.
So these are formative years when you were just getting into business?
Yes, it was. Yep.
And I guess when did you make this transition to become a winemaker? When did you decide you wanted to go down this career path?
Well, my experience there really was my epiphany, if you will. I went over there to really on a consulting job and was just really pleasantly surprised that in Burgundy, all the winemakers there, if you want to call them that, vignerons, considered themselves first and foremost farmers. Well, that was a resounding alarm that went off for me, having grown up like most of us have with California wines over the years in the 50s, 60s, 70s, that it was all done in the winery and celebrated winemakers and everything. Nobody talked about where the fruit came from. Nobody talked about the vineyard, none of that. So my experience in Burgundy really took me back to my growing up, which I grew up on a farm in Iowa.
Whereabouts in Iowa?
Oakland, very southwest corner. So our farm was right on Highway 6, about 30 miles east of Omaha, Nebraska. So anyway, that's my background. So for me, farming and then seeing that come back in Burgundy really gave me the opportunity to take that and my love of wine and bring those two things together. So after that, my 2 years experience in Burgundy, I really came away from there saying, you know what, that's really what I want to do. And that began the start of the journey to come to where we came.
Yeah, amazing. Well, let's go back to your own experience with wine. Were you immediately a Pinot drinker? Was this something you eventually worked your way into?
No. As a matter of fact, Pinot didn't come to me until I was in Burgundy. Again, growing up in the 50s and 60s and then growing up in wine in really the 70s and the 80s, it was all the big red. So my uncle actually lived in Sonoma, Rohnert Park. And I traveled there a lot and spent a lot of time out there. And so it was all California, Cabernets. Sure. And so that's really what I... And then I expanded as I grew older into Bordeaux's. But I really hadn't gotten into Burgundy so much. So that was another part of my epiphany in when I was in Burgundy is... Oh my God, you know, Burgundy and Chardonnay done very differently than Chardonnay was being done in California. Falling in love with the cooler climate Chardonnay and having that whole experience, it was just a bam, bam, bam of learning experience that I came away with there.
Nice. With your experience in the wine business, this could be a positive or negative answer depending how you look at it, but what makes you crazy about the wine business?
Selling it. And I could go take this in a lot of different directions, but I used to be, my education is as a mechanical engineer. So you may or may not know in engineering, the old adage is, well, if you build it or if you make it, you know, they will come, right? Like the Iowa baseball field, sure. You know. And of course, that's not the case. You can make the best mousetrap in the world, but you still got to sell it.
Right.
And the same is with wine. We joke about it a lot in the industry is that we're all doing what we love, which is we're growing grapes and we're making wine and we're sharing it with our fans and with anybody that really can appreciate wine, the agricultural aspect of wine. But what we end up spending over 75% of our time doing is trying to sell it. And particularly here in the Willamette Valley, with the fact that most of us are very small producers and the three-tier distribution system, which we have to go through, continues to get bigger and bigger and more consolidated, it's become much, much, much more difficult. Therefore, we have to look at other avenues in which to get our product in people's mouths. And direct-to-consumer through tasting rooms, through wine clubs, through all those things are part of that, but that takes a lot of time and splits you up into a lot of different directions. So it's the fact that if you were spending as much of your time growing the grapes and making the wine as you were selling it, then it'd be a pretty good balance. But overwhelmingly, we're spending a lot more time just having to try to sell it. And so that's my biggest frustration. The flip side of that, I'm doing what I'm doing because I love being out in nature. I love being out farming. And, you know, my dad always said, and one of my French tutors, one of my French vignerons over, said the same thing. He said, you don't ever wake up in the morning and think about having to go to work. You just get up and start living. And if you take that approach at it, you know, getting up at 5:30 in the morning and going and walking the vineyards when the light is just right to be able to see everything and checking for powdery mildew and all that, and just being out in nature is a wonderful thing. And probably more than those three young daughters on the picture up there keep me as young as I am. So,
well, I think making wine is a very much a physical job and a mental job and a predicting job and living in the past job and being in the I mean, you as a winemaker wear a whole lot of hats, far mm-hmm. above just about any business I can think of.
Well, it's like any business that you own, actually. I mean, if you think, even if you're an independent carpenter, you're wearing a lot of hats.
True.
You know, or an electrician or whatever it is, you're wearing a lot of hats. So I think as a farmer, as a winemaker, as a marketer, yes, I'm wearing a lot of hats. But I think part of that is just by virtue of the fact that it's your own business.
That's your name.
Yeah, it is. Well, you know, and again, it's a positive, a negative, but it's also a positive sure. because when I'm, you know, oftentimes I get asked, well, gosh, don't you get tired of talking about your wines? And I go, no, it's like talking about my daughters. It's about talking about my family. I lived with the fruit all year that went into the making of this wine that you're appreciating. And the fact that you're loving the wine, the fact that you joined the wine club, the fact that you're, you know, walking out of here with the case, all those things are just a pat on the back for me that, you know, all the work and effort and everything that I went into to create that product is appreciated and loved. And so that makes it all worthwhile.
Okay, I'm done. Good. No.
Fantastic.
No, I'm just kidding. What has become my favorite question to ask winemakers is this idea of we all who do things that we love for a living enjoy talking about it to the right people, people who understand it. So with that in mind, for all the times you've been around media or talked to writers, what's the question that you don't get asked that you wish someone would ask you?
Wow. That's a tough question because I've been asked almost everything that I can possibly think of. The one question that doesn't get asked enough. Let me start with that. Is with respect, how does what I do from a farming standpoint impact the wine? And I, because everybody's always asking, well, what are you doing to make the wine? You know, how many new barrels are you using? What kind of wood you use and how long is it in barrel? Sure. Blah, blah, blah. You know, and you know, nobody asks, you know, how are you farming? You know, I make a point of everybody that I can that to remind people that the wine in your glass is an agricultural product. And it's not a product that is a production product. It's not produced. It's not like Coca-Cola. There's no recipe. It is grown in the fields. I can't make the quality of that wine any better than the fruit that's coming out of the vineyard. I can change it. I can make it taste different. But I can't make the quality higher. So it all goes back to that. And so the question is never asked is, well, how do you get there? How do you do that? And for me, it's a little different than what others might say. And that is that less is more, is that I take a very, anything that we do is having a negative impact on the ability for those vines to grow the best fruit possible in the environment that they're in. And I always use the analogy, it's like thinking about you taking care of your body homeopathically. We find out that most anything that our body's having issues is because of something we've done to it. Something we've eaten, environment we're in, whatever it is. The farm's the same way.
Sure.
So it's typically something that we're doing that's throwing nature out of balance and throwing things off and changing the environment or changing the dynamics. So I try as much as possible not to do that. Now, of course, because of the virtue that we're farming and that we're trellising and that we're pruning and we're doing all those things, we're already impacting it. So minimizing that and trying to make sure that anything that we do either counters that or continues to minimize that is the best thing that we can do. And so that's what I will often call my holistic approach to farming, which is really looking at farming with nature and being with nature. And that's when you get your best product in terms of the fruit. If you carry that into the winery, you'll also get the best product into the bottle. And that's what I'm all about.
That was a really good answer. That was a very good answer.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, considering the fact we have three daughters, and, you know, there's a part of family history that wineries become, family-owned wineries, do you think any of them are going to head down this path at all and follow you?
I think so. I read a book probably 5 years ago now by the Father Antonori, and he had three daughters as well. Mm. And the bottom line of the book was make them go away and discover themselves, appreciate what they had, and then, you know, if they come back, they do. If they don't, they don't. You know, they found their own passion. And so that's really what I want to do, I'm trying to do. They're young yet.
Yeah, I'm trying to.
They're 19, 16, and 12.
Thank you.
And my 19-year-old is actually, while she has her own aspirations in terms of her own passion and career, she believes that she can do that and take over the family business as well. So she has all intents and purposes to continue to learn to grow grapes and to make wine, and shows a lot of interest in it. My middle daughter, Jordan, the day she graduates from high school, she's out of here. Not because I'm forcing her out, because she wants to go explore the world. She wants to be an entertainer and be far away. So will she be crawling back on her hands and knees 6 months or a year from now? Who knows? But I would not be surprised if she didn't come back. And then my youngest, she's actually showing the most affinity for nature and the farming practices, the animals, you know, which are a part of the balance of life on the hill that you want to have. She's showing a lot of that. So I think I got a really good chance at least 1 out of 3, maybe 2 out of 3.
Yeah, that's not bad. That's yeah, pretty good.
Those odds are good. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to go back to the fact we have the cattle here too, which are the Scottish
Highland Coos.
Highland Coos, yeah. They're amazing creatures to be close to.
Yeah.
So are you biodynamic here then?
We are. Not certified, but I'm not concerned about certification because, I'm not going to do things to get certification that I don't see needing to be done. So that's one part of it. The other part is I'm doing it because I think it's the right thing to do. Biodynamics, and I say that I do it holistically or pragmatically, it's all about balance and allowing nature to be in balance. Well, cows are a very fundamental part of that. They not only provide balance in terms of animal life on the hill, but their manure impacts positively on the balance of plant life. And therefore, with balance in plant life, you get balance of insect life. So all three of those things kind of evolve around each other, and it's all part of being a diverse environment just as well as it's one of the healthy things I think we have here in the Willamette Valley, is that we have a true diversity in terms of agriculture. And that it will also drive diversity in terms of plant life and insect life, and that keeps us from getting infestations of a lot of things.
Which is nice. Well, not only yeah. that, but they're cool to have around because they look so cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so funny because we've had horses out there, and, you know, everybody's got horses, right? We had a black Angus cow. It was my wife's choice. And, of course, I grew up on a farm with a herd of 50 black Angus cows. Wow. So for me, the black Angus was like, everybody's got that, right? And so, but she wanted to have what she considered the pretty cow. And so they were Beauty and Beast. And after 5 years of everybody taking pictures of the Highland coos and nobody taking a picture of the black Angus cow, she finally gave up and said, oh, we don't need the black Angus cow here on the hill anymore. So,
oh, poor little guy. He's going to have a thing going on.
Yeah, she'll get over it.
Yeah, I'm sure he will. For the tasting room here, which you said is part of the Innis, and I'm assuming because of the layout here, this is by appointment, or could people just come up here? Or?
So, no, we do both up here. We have just drive-by traffic that comes in. So our tasting room on the other side is what I would consider kind of the more casual standard tasting that anybody can come in anytime during our hours from 10 to 4. Then in this room, this is our more formal seated tasting experience, which we try to tailor this to what the guest is looking for. And then we do that not only for the Youngberg Hill brand, but we'll be doing seated tastings by appointment for our new brand, the Bailey Family Wines as well.
Which we didn't get a chance to touch on, which we should real quick. This is something brand new, but it's not on the market yet?
No, it's not. And in fact, it's not going to be on the market. It's going to be a product that's on allocation only, very small production, and really fine-tuned to the individuals that are really wanting wines that are collectible. They're made to age. And are really unique. So they're not going to be on grocery shelves. They're not going to be in restaurants. They're not. You're not even going to be able to buy them here, except if you are, you know,
in the wine club,
in the member. Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. Very cool. And for our listeners to learn a little bit more about you online, what's your website?
It is www.youngberghill, and that's Young and Berg, B-E-R-G, hill.com.
Excellent. Wayne, you're totally a pleasure to talk to, and I really do appreciate you taking the time on this overcast, kind of crazy up and down day. Thanks very much.
Thank you for being here, Ray. Hope you enjoy it.
Totally.
Good.
Learn more by visiting youngberghill.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Additional original music by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Photos by Jeanette Herniak and Catherine Shearer. Copyright 2019.